prices will move on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. Instead, we look at long-term structural drivers.
The impact of falling oil prices on Alaska's budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, kids in Unalaska plan out their ideal town.
Wild Hills has hills, mountains, and safetiness.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ready to quit smoking using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Around 1 p.m. today, Governor Sean Parnell's office turned over nearly 600 pages of emails and records concerning the administration's response to misconduct in the Alaska National Guard. The documents come 5 months after they were originally requested and one day after a Superior Court judge ordered the administration to make them available. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has been working through the documents and is here to tell us what's in them so far. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
First off, how complete are the documents? Are they mostly redacted or is there actual information in them?
While there are some documents that are entirely blacked out, there's also plenty in there that isn't. I'm on about page 400 of 596, so I haven't seen it all, but there is stuff in there that hasn't been previously available. You can see about a dozen separate people from the Guard contacted the governor's office with specific complaints about leadership in 2011 alone. While the administration has listed victims' privacy as a reason for not sharing emails, it's pretty clear the bulk of the correspondence with whistleblowers had to do with what was going on at the top. We also see that the governor's chief of staff, Mike Nizek, is responsive, especially 4 years ago when complaints started coming in. However, with later complaints and especially after communications breakdown with the chaplains toward the end of 2011, there's a little bit less patience in there. And specifically when it comes to one person who's viewed it as a disgruntled employee, he and then Adjutant General Thomas Katkus make it pretty obvious in their tone that they're just tired of dealing with him.
What are some of the documents that stand out to you so far?
Oh, there's a lot. For one, there's an anonymous letter from a group that describes itself as Friends of the Alaska National Guard from 2012. And at the top of it, it says it's an open letter to the Alaska State Legislature. I'm still trying to confirm whether the legislature ever got this or not, because in the documents, the few letters that are from legislators seem to express surprise that anything is going on. But the letter does call out Guard leadership and specifically names Katkus, who was asked to resign 2 months ago because of problems in the Guard. It also expresses disappointment with the governor and his staff. May I read from some of it?
Please do.
While it is unfortunate what Katkus has done, it is even more regrettable that another senior leader in the state of Alaska has overlooked the misconduct. Governor Sean Parnell and his staff were notified of these issues on multiple occasions by more than a dozen mid to high-ranking officers in the Alaska National Guard. While the governor has listened to the concerns of the leaders in the organization, he has failed to investigate the facts surrounding Katkus and the corruption within the Alaska National Guard. After that, the rest of the document is redacted. But again, just to reiterate, that was from 2012. That was 2 years before an investigation was called for.
Alexandra, is there much communication from the governor?
There's very little. When the problems with the Guard started getting more news coverage earlier this year, there was a staff email he sent that expressed disappointment and indignation that people would suggest that he didn't do enough, and that really emphasized that the integrity of the Guard is important to him. We know that he had met with chaplains about 4 years ago and that he was getting briefed on the matter, but there isn't much of a paper trail when it comes to the governor. However, there is one email from June 8th, 2014 that was kind of even a punch in the gut for me to read. And I have it here. And again, if I may.
Yes, please.
If you haven't already, please have General Katkus give direction that McHugh should have absolutely nothing to do with cases where Guard members are under investigation or subject to review, especially as they relate to the two people he is personally connected to. No viewing of files, no conversations, etc. The reason this email was difficult for me to read was because it's referring to Deputy Commissioner McHugh Pierre, who was asked to resign a full 3 months later. While the governor never explained the reason for the dismissal, there were reports that it was because Pierre interfered on behalf of a friend's disciplinary proceeding. There's no mention of discipline from the governor for Pierre or potentially a suspension in the letter. It just says stop doing that. So if those allegations about Pierre and his involvement in friends' cases are true, that means Pierre was able to stay in the second most powerful position at the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs until federal investigators concluded that the Guard had problems with favoritism and cronyism like that alleged case.
All right. Thank you, Alexandra, for your hard work on this. And thanks for giving us that update.
Thank you, Lori.
That was APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez. Crude oil prices are hovering in the $80 range, and in Alaska, that brings with it worries over the budget. But economists from either side of the political spectrum have roughly the same take on what's playing out. It's too early to tell. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Crude oil prices haven't been on this long and steady of a decline in more than a decade, but the state has been here before.
Dropped briefly to $9 a barrel.
Greg Erickson is an economist who runs a private consulting firm and says people tend to forget that as recently as 1999, Alaska was dealing with crude prices in the single digits.
For a number of years now, people have sort of gotten the idea that $100 oil is the new normal. I never thought that, and I think there's many people with a long historical perspective never thought it either.
The problem, though, is that by this point, the state's budget depends on oil being in the triple digits. Money for roads, schools, basic government services, all of that is paid for under the assumption that North Slope producers will sell to refineries at over $100 a barrel. So shouldn't the state's economists be freaking out?
Prices will move on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. Instead, we look at long-term structural drivers.
Mike Pawlowski is the deputy commissioner at the state's Department of Revenue, and he's actually pretty calm right now. He says there's a lot that's driving the price decline in the crude markets. There's shale oil coming out of North Dakota, OPEC producers struggling to maintain their market shares, more refining on the West Coast. But Pawlowski says the state's revenue modeling is built around a longer timetable than just this last period of slumping crude prices.
We look at it largely on annual averages, rather than trying to predict daily, weekly, or even monthly moves in prices.
Pawlowski also says that while the revenue department didn't see this current dip coming, oil at around $80 a barrel was within the range they'd thought possible, and hardly a catastrophe. And unlike most of the country, producers in Alaska can send crude abroad, something ConocoPhillips did this month when it exported a shipment to South Korea for the first time in 8 years. Pawlowski says those options give Alaska more flexibility if crude prices don't change course.
And I think that benefit in the long term might provide some real protection for Alaska vis-a-vis if there is competition on the West Coast.
Oil economics in Alaska is inherently political, especially in an election year and especially in this one, when SB 21 let voters weigh in on the tax structure. But number crunchers on both sides of the spectrum say spending cuts or drawing down savings will almost inevitably be a part of budgeting again this year if prices don't rebound dramatically. But that's par for the course when nearly all of your revenues are tied to one of the most volatile commodity markets on the planet. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a murder mystery party.
The misery, the triumph, the lust. You, sir, seem to be a little bit suspect.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
The trial of Leroy B. Dick Jr. is scheduled to get underway Monday in Dillingham. Dick, now 44, is accused of murdering Village Public Safety Officer Thomas Madole in Manicotic on March 19, 2013. Madole, an unarmed VPSO, had gone to Dick's home after taking a report of domestic disturbance and a possible suicidal person. When state troopers in Dillingham flew to the village immediately after reports of gunfire, they found Officer Madole's body steps from Dick's front door. Inside, Leroy Dick had cleaned and put away his .223 rifle, and he was arrested. Dick was arraigned the following day. During that hearing and a later interview with KDLG News, he appeared to take responsibility for the murder, but has since maintained a not guilty plea. Dick's defense attorney requested moving the trial out of the Dillingham court, but that motion was denied by presiding judge Gregory Miller. The state is seeking a mandatory minimum 99-year sentence if Dick is convicted of the first-degree murder charge. Tom Madole was 54 years old when he was killed. A retired minister, Madole served as the Manicotic VPSO from 2011 until his death in 2013. Two investigators from the state fire marshal's office completed their work at the site of the fire that destroyed the new Bethel Alcohol Treatment Center. Lloyd Nakano is an assistant state fire marshal.
The on-scene has been completed. However, possibly more follow-ups with interviews could be possible.
4 days after the enormous fire that leveled the $12.5 million facility, which was being enclosed for the winter, Nakano says he doesn't know the cause of the fire. He wouldn't say what sort of tools, heaters, or equipment were present that might have caused the fire. They have not ruled out the possibility of arson, but also will not say whether they believe the fire was intentionally set. YK Delta State Senator Lyman Hoffman surprised some people when he endorsed Republican Dan Sullivan for U.S. Senate. In an interview with KYUK Today, Hoffman explained why he took a stance in the high-profile race in which Sullivan is seeking Senator Mark Begich's job. Hoffman brought up Sullivan's help in settling a lawsuit against the state, the Casile case, which addressed inequality in school construction spending in rural Alaska.
Through the process, with his support, eventually the Casile case got resolved. We have spent tens of millions of dollars since then constructing rural schools. We're in the process of completing a 40-some million dollar school at Gwichluk.
Sullivan was attorney general near the end of the 14 years of litigation and was natural resources commissioner when the settlement was announced. Hoffman also points to Sullivan's role in resolving litigation about Alaska Native voting access. Reducing the cost of energy in Western Alaska is an area in which Hoffman says Sullivan can play a role.
We haven't had much progress on that issue at the national level. So I think with his track record, I think he can accomplish something.
Hoffman is running unopposed for re-election this November. Laying out neighborhoods isn't the world's most glamorous job, but every October, urban planners make an extra effort to get people interested in that work for National Community Planning Month. In Unalaska, that meant helping some of the town's youngest residents design a world all their own. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal was invited to take a tour and brought back this report.
The back room of Unalaska's community center was clearly made for kids, packed with toys, painted in primary colors. Even the tables and chairs sit extra low to the ground, but no one is using them today. Instead, 30 elementary schoolers are on their feet reviewing a model city they made from scratch.
What's this area right here?
This is Hamburger Street.
I'm so...
What's on Hamburger Street?
What are all those?
There's hamburger restaurants and stores.
Welcome to Hamburger Town.
Where even the mountains look like hamburgers.
That's Erin Reinders. She's the lead planner for the city of Unalaska, and for the past month, she and a colleague have been leading an after-school program showing kids what it takes to create a community. Hamburger Town and the city of Wild Hills might be made of paper, but Reinders says they've gone through a pretty realistic planning process.
We broke it up into two towns, and they made their natural environment and their built environment, and we talked a little bit about zoning.
That's on Melanie's mind as she gets ready to glue down a paper house on a quiet corner in Hamburger Town. The 7-year-old says she feels good about the location.
Because it says it right here, where should houses go and, like, restaurants.
Melanie's pointing to a crayon and marker drawing hanging on the wall. It's a zoning map, and it wasn't easy to make. Melanie says everyone had to sit still for a really long time. The grown-up planners asked questions, and the kids had to agree where everything should go. But they had to get it done so they could move on to the best part.
When we're coloring the houses and we're making them.
9-year-old Jonathan was gone for a lot of that process. He joined the project late, and by the time he made it to Wild Hills, the team had already placed 4 volcanoes around the city. They also applied for building permits and started making houses, but Jonathan doesn't seem to mind.
Wild Hills has hills, mountains, and safetiness. One of the volcanoes has lots of room between it and houses. The other one is pretty close to houses, but not too much.
It's a great community, on paper. But what if it were real? Would Jonathan want to live in Wild Hills?
Yes, but if there were robbers, I would rather have a police station.
There's no police station?
Nope. None of the 2 cities have police stations.
It's not because they're soft on crime, though. Reinders, the city planner, says both teams talked about what kind of government they wanted, and they agreed that law enforcement was important enough to get its own building.
Because I think you'll see one that says police station and fire station.
While the kids sit down for a quick meeting with a teacher from the community center, Reinders sneaks away to confirm there's no sign of the cop shop in the Hamburger Town Square. She looks through a plastic bucket full of buildings the team ran out of time for, and buried at the bottom, she finds the police station. It's a little crumpled, but nothing a glue stick can't fix.
So I, right now, am repairing our police station and fire station. And I'm making sure that I'm about to put it in an area that it's zoned for, based on the zoning map that they came up with. So I'm going to put it in a blue area.
As Reinders glues the building down, Jonathan stops by to ask about the last-minute construction.
What is that? Is that a police station?
This is the police station. In both towns have a police station.
So thank you for sharing your concern, because then we were able to fix that.
Before he leaves to join the other kids, Jonathan gives Hamburger Town one last look.
With a few changes and with magic, it could turn into a real city.
That, and maybe some planning. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ann Bryce. This week on AK, murder. Don't worry, nobody's actually getting killed. Instead, we're planning a murder mystery party with an Anchorage business called Outcast Productions. Elisa Hitchcock and Kimberly Gray have been running the business for 2 decades. APRN's Dave Waldron enlisted a few colleagues to give a murder mystery party a try.
Elisa says one of the most crucial elements to a good mystery is assigning the right person the right character.
We recognize the personality and the character. We just kind of read them a little bit.
For this party, they'll be assigning characters to 4 of my coworkers. What's shocking is Elisa and Kimberly have just met them, but the characters Kimberly assigns them are spot on with their actual personalities.
And we're going to start with you. You are our tour guide for the night.
Okay.
You have been, you know this home inside and out. You know where all the ghosts live, and you know all the stories.
Can her name be Jane?
Jane. Jane it is. We have Clyde here, and Clyde's a skeptic. He doesn't believe in ghosts. He's never liked ghosts.
Jane, real name Anne, is actually the most excited about the murder mystery tonight. Clyde, real name John, is by far the most skeptical. We'll get to that more in a second. Next, we have Frank, real name John. He's the new guy. And lastly, we have Sylvia, real name Lori, the reporter with an accent.
A really, really bad British accent.
That works too.
And here is the plot of tonight's story.
We work for the American Society of Haunted Homes. So it's an association. The National Association has challenged us to be in this home for the night.
The way this party will work is Kimberly will be acting and trying to lead the other actors in certain directions at certain times. Elisa will play the role of director. So remember how I said Kimberly picked the roles of my coworkers perfectly? This is Jane, the tour guide, and Clyde, the skeptic.
Please combine all of your experiences. The misery, the triumph, the lust. You, sir, seem to be a little bit suspect. I thought you were with the society.
Well, I am with the society, of course, but...
Mr. Clyde, is
I'm
that
Clyde.
Your name?
Yes,
Mr.
I'm
Clyde.
Clyde,
why don't you come and join me in the gentleman's chamber?
Jane then leads the group into the amethyst chamber, a room completely decorated in purple. Apparently, according to Jane, the woman that used to live here loved purple so much that she ate some poisonous monk's hood and died.
Sometimes it reminds me of the horrid vomit that came out of her when she was poisoned. If you notice
purple?
That stain that is over on the floor in the far corner where the chamber pot used to be held. She died right here. Now, Sylvia, it seems like you will be the one sleeping in this room tonight.
Oh,
are you
good,
prepared?
Good.
I'm starting to wonder about that. Vomit and death all in the same room?
It's all right.
That's purple. You'll love it.
Nothing's going to happen.
The guests will settle into each of their haunted rooms until they are summoned for dinner.
All we right, will then. Be having pizza. We really couldn't afford anything else. The kitchen's still haunted and the cooks won't come back. We just had to get a pizza from the local place. Sorry about
pizza.
That. Anyhow, ta-ta, toodaloo. See you all at 8.
And this is when Elisa writes Kimberly a note on a small piece of paper. It says to kill Frank. The only problem, Frank doesn't want to die.
Oh my God, I'm going to scream. Frank, what's wrong? He's not moving, he's not breathing. What's going on? Frank? Oh my gosh, something's happened to Frank. I've got to
get
the
tour guide. Me and the ghost are just playing this game where I pretend I'm dead.
Gosh, don't do that to me. We're in a haunted house.
Then Frank decides to do some directing of his own.
But anyways, then I went into the garage. I found these Molsons that were in a fridge. Also, there's a dead chef in there. He looked Swedish.
You saw the dead Swedish chef and you weren't at all concerned?
He went for the
beer. He went for some beers.
Am I not telling you guys now? I was concerned. I was also concerned about the beer situation in the house.
I'm so sorry about the chef.
So we have our murder, or at least a body. Now the group just needs to figure out how the chef died and when.
I can't say for sure when he died, but I can say for sure it was before I had my first Molson, and he was definitely dead since I've had 6 more after that one.
Did you smell him?
I could smell him.
Elisa writes Kimberly another note. It says, the tour guide did it.
Stay away from the tour guide. And now we're locked in this dumb house with her.
She is a bit weird.
The person who's obviously going around killing Swedish chefs, creating new ghosts to supply her business.
The group is just about to lock Jane in the amethyst room. Then the story takes one more wonky twist, courtesy of Frank.
I killed the chef. I had to do it.
Clyde.
I've had the pizza from that place down the street before, and I was not going to settle for that. Swedish meatballs are nothing.
Were you planning on eating the chef then?
Well, it was a crime of passion. I didn't really think it out much past that point.
Our tale ends with Frank locked up and the rest of the group waiting for the Mounties to arrive. Oh, I forgot to say, we somehow ended up in Canada.
We should have a beer while we wait.
Have a beer.
That's fair.
Everybody.
Cheers.
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 Woo! May the Swedish chef rest in peace.
And may there be more Molson soon.
Ooh. For AK, I'm Dave Waldron.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Twin Hills near Bristol Bay.
I'm William Alupchik. I'm from Twin Hills, and I work in the council office as a grant writer. There's mountainous and hilly. You could say we're sort of a coastal village. You know, they do the arts and crafts, skin sewing, ivory carving, boat riding, few other ways people can make have a fun time. You know, if hunting itself is fun, or if you go out to seal hunt or out fishing or something, you know, sport fishing. It's close to trout fishing, salmon fishing, it's close to commercial fishing, it's close to the sea and to the land mammals here. Close to the ocean out here, you get, you know, walrus out there and seals. That's why I like it here. It's close to what I like to do. It's still cultural and, you know, and modern at the same time, I would think. We're, you know, we still, the most of the older groups, they speak the local Yupik language. Mix them, or they talk them both, you know. And, you know, we do have some crafts that go on. Like, we do have a skin sewing class. The kids also learn from watching their parents or elders, like skin a flock, skin a beaver or seal, and make seal oil or something. We normally have maybe a potluck once in a while or a public meeting, but we have potlucks at the school where we gather. But we do have at least one public meeting a year.
William Alutzik is a grant writer for the village of Twin Hills. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Waldron, Ashley Snyder, and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ann Bryce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie the Axe Fight. Our audio engineer is Monster Monica Goki. Josh Wolfman Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Gimme Some Candy Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.